Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. So now, yet another world conference on euphemistic sounding climate change, the latest in a succession of gaudy pageants that are more or less emblematic of a major human schism, the disparity between the scornful deceit of wealth and power and the debilitating impotence of poverty. It would seem that a central purpose of these conferences has been the opportunity of those who cause and benefit most from environmental devastation of the planet and atmosphere to ensure the consequences fall upon those least responsible and most vulnerable. At least the principal perpetrators no longer have the luxury of denial. Yet an inexcusable omission remains the failure to ensure an equal ratio between women and men to climate change harangues. Women's presence and power of purpose should be a fundamental priority. After all, men are the major culprits responsible for the impending global catastrophe that threatens human continuance on Mother Earth. And the world's children will most likely not have much of a presence, but they do have an irresistible voice. Greta Thunberg. Forget all the politically connected climate bigshots who are clustering in Glasgow, Scotland. Greta Thunberg just might be the most important person in the world and whom everybody should listen to. We deserve a safe future, and we demand a safe future, she says, speaking for the unheard children. Is that really too much to ask? The world needs Greta Thunberg, like roses need rain, to borrow from a Johnny Mathis song. She is a 21st century secular Joan of Arc, who is also confronting the flames as she inspires multitudes of children and young people everywhere to save Mother Gaia. She is a new millennium child, born in 2003, and she is horrified that she and every child and young person alive on Earth and every subsequent generation of children are born into the age of the sixth great extinction. She was born with Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism defined as deeply self-absorbed and detached from reality, which, especially regarding her, is 180 degrees opposite reality. She has emerged from anguished melancholia to an unblinkered commitment to prevent Earth from becoming a burnt, dead planet, lifeless as the rest of the neighboring planets. She began her intensely focused and initially solitary crusade to save planet Earth and the human species, as well as all other earthly biology, from anthropogenic holocaust, 3 years ago by picketing the Swedish parliament in her home city of Stockholm, sitting alone on the steps of the Capitol with a hand-lettered sign, "School Strike for Climate." And by acting quite literally as a Swedish nightingale, sounding alarm in the proverbial and combustible planetary coal mine, she has become an immortal whose name will be elevated from now until humanity's literal burnout or climate redivivus. Diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, she says, basically means I only speak when I think it is necessary. And now it is one of those moments. And it would seem that only within moments, millions of children began organizing similar protests around the world, especially in their schools. Although there remains even now a tremendous political and societal rift worldwide about global warming, the critical partisan divide might be between generations. The more passively elderly who will quit the planet soon, especially hastened by the current pandemic, and think nothing can be done or are unwilling to change their polluting ways, versus the young, who urgently feel the need to reverse the grim probabilities of a harrowing future now before it is too late. Greta Thunberg has acted as a climate Cassandra with her no-nonsense, in-everybody's-face straight talk. You are failing us, but the young people are starting to understand your betrayal, she said 2 years ago at a United Nations climate change summit. The eyes of all future generations are upon you, she said, and if you choose to fail us, I say, we will never forgive you. People are suffering, she says. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are at the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. John Forbes Kerry, USA climate czar and Glasgow conference ringmaster, former senator, secretary of state, and U.S. Navy Vietnam War veteran with a Silver Star and two Purple Hearts, whose political career began as an eloquent spokesman for Vietnam veterans against the war, should team up with Greta Thunberg and the Children's Crusade to save Earth and humanity's future, the real heart and soul of the Glasgow Conference. And Glasgow should remain perpetually in session with international staffs of women, men, and children working daily to oversee efforts throughout the world to force down the global emissions killing Earth's sky. Even if humanity might fully unite to escape the ravages of an overheated planet, my beloved Saul, there are quite a few more possibilities of human-induced extinction that might be considered aside from baking like pies. The human species might, as a corollary to the current pandemic, which has so far killed 5 million and counting worldwide, finally lose its oldest and most desperate struggle against microscopic viruses. At some vulnerable moment, a bacterial virus of such intensity and opportunity will quite likely surge through humanity before it is able to defend itself. Another worldwide pandemic, if not a resurgence of this current one, might deliberately or accidentally be unleashed from lethal viruses or chemicals that are human-originated to wipe out entire populations. And of course, we might reactivate the old hobgoblin of nuclear holocaust and blast ourselves out of the universe in the manner our previous millennial predecessors came very close to doing during the half-century Cold War of the 20th century. Each and every one of these calamitous possibilities piggybacks every other dire probability of disaster. No one is to blame for anything, yet we all are at fault for everything. As Oliver Hardy always accused Stan Laurel, this is another fine mess you have got us into. And P.S. Earth might yet be hit by a space rock that was previously said to hit us around 2028, but is now claimed to miss us by a country mile. But who really knows? And now, on a similar subject, from the Guardian newspaper, by Rebecca Willis, the big idea is democracy up to the task of climate change. It is time to acknowledge a difficult truth. Our democracies are failing us on the climate crisis. As world leaders meet for the crucial Glasgow summit, rhetorical commitments abound. But no government has a plan compatible with the goal that they have all agreed is critical to our collective future: limiting global average temperatures rises to 1.5 centigrade. In some democracies, such as the United Kingdom, there is at least a consensus that something must be done. In others, such as Australia, Canada, and the U.S., political debate rages over the most fundamental questions. Faced with the problem of these proportions, some are running out of patience. The veteran earth scientist, James Lovelock, puts his faith in eco-authoritarianism. Climate change is so severe, he has said, that, quote, it may be necessary to put democracy on hold for a while. Lovelock may state this explicitly, but in my many years of work on climate policy and politics, I have been struck by how often people make the same argument implicitly. Bill Gates, in his breathlessly upbeat book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, describes how enlightened investment strategies from well-meaning entrepreneurs could save the day. No need to bother, he implies, with winning hearts, minds, or votes. Then there are those who look approvingly towards China, a country where the very lack of democratic accountability, they argue, allows leaders to take tough and unpopular decisions. The common theme in all these accounts is that the public are not to be trusted. They do not understand or care. They are too selfish or too short-sighted. Better to let the experts decide. Yet proposals for some sort of eco-authoritarianism raise more questions than they answer. How exactly do we move beyond democracy? Who appoints the experts? Scientists may have evidence at their disposal, but how would they make deeply social decisions about who wins and who loses? Under whose authority would they regulate? And how exactly would that regulation happen? How would laws be made? The best that can be said about these proposals is that they gloss over the complex realities of political, social, and legal change. There is also the fact that authoritarianism has not performed any better historically. A recent study by the University of Gothenburg's VDEM Institute showed that autocratic regimes lag significantly on climate action. Given the economic and political might of China, we have to hope that they may find a way to buck this trend, but it would be reckless, not to mention ethically dubious, to suggest China as a political role model on climate. Despite the considerable flaws in our democratic systems, the alternatives crumble under any sort of close inspection. It is hard to disagree with Churchill's pithy summary that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. That was Winston Churchill. My experience leads me to a very different conclusion to that of the eco-authoritarians. The data just doesn't support the picture of an uncaring or uninformed public. Research consistently shows high levels of concern about climate change across different ages, demographic groups, and parts of the world. Yet this concern is coupled with a deep mistrust in government and political elites, and a breakdown in the means by which people's priorities are translated into political action. To generalize, we have a population that is cynical, yet concerned about the climate, frustrated with the inability of politicians to act decisively in the face of growing climate impacts. Could it be that the problem here is not too much democracy, but too little? What if we were to begin with the assumption that people can and do make sensible decisions if they have the evidence and the influence that they need? That if we designed a meaningful dialogue between citizens, experts, and governments, we would get better outcomes. Just before COVID-19 struck last year, I was part of an incredible experiment that did just this. Climate Assembly, United Kingdom, was a citizens' assembly commissioned by Parliament, bringing together a representative group of 108 citizens. Over a series of weekends, they learned about climate science, impacts, and action, discussed and debated with experts and each other, and then voted on recommendations. The assembly's findings are a coherent, far-reaching set of proposals for tackling the climate emergency, created by a different sort of democratic body. Processes such as this are not intended to replace our system of representative democracy, but to make it work better. They allow citizens and politicians alike to talk about what they need from each other. Citizens' assemblies on the climate crisis have now taken place in Scotland, France, Denmark, and some U.S. states, as well as at a local level in many areas. They show the potential of a move to a more deliberative democracy, one which goes beyond the blunt instrument of a vote toward an informed conversation. But making democracy work better for climate doesn't just mean hearing from more people. It means hearing less from those economic interests, such as oil majors and airlines, that have a stake in the high carbon status quo. We have recently seen corporations suing governments under trade law, claiming that climate policy passed by democratically elected parliaments has damaged their profits and is therefore illegal. U.S. scientist Michael Mann has documented this new climate war, which is in quotes. He shows that denial of the scientific facts of climate change has been replaced with more complex but equally insidious attempts to delay or derail legislation. A key tactic, Mann shows, is to deflect attention away from the workings of big companies and towards individuals by saying that it is up to each of us to make the right choices and reduce our carbon footprint. When this doesn't happen, it is a short step to blaming people for the state we are in and undermining faith in the ability of democracies to handle the climate crisis. What is necessary, then, is not to dispense with democracy, but to double down on it. Seeing climate change not as something that can be solved by experts, nor through individual sacrifices, but by the negotiation of a new sort of social contract between people and the state. The novelist Amitav Ghosh refers to our current climate predicament as a great derangement, quote unquote, a collective reluctance to face up to the reality of how the crisis will affect our lives. Pretending that we can bypass people and democracy is, to my mind, the ultimate derangement. And that was the big idea. Is democracy up to the task of climate change? And Rebecca Willis is a professor of energy and climate governance at the University of Lancaster and the author of Too Hot to Handle, The Democratic Challenge of Climate Change. She wrote this for The Guardian. And now, Monopoly is Not Just a Board Game by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. Using the term in its broadest sense, monopoly includes everything from a single company controlling a market to a half dozen companies working in a cartel-like fashion. When President Ronald Reagan's Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice stopped enforcing the anti-monopoly laws in 1982, working people's pay stopped rising. The rich have gotten fabulously richer since then. Consumers, when harmed or ripped off, have been stripped of their legal powers to hold businesses accountable. America now lags behind other countries in innovation, which is why we have the highest pharmaceutical and health care costs in the world. Our streets are filled with guns. Our schools have been stripped of books and school supplies. And our food is so deficient in nutrients that we're experiencing a malnutrition-induced obesity epidemic. Monopoly is why it is so hard to start a new business, particularly a small local business, and so difficult for existing local and regional companies to survive. It is why pension funds have been legally stolen and the vast majority of workers have lost or been denied the right to representation in the workplace. Monopoly is why so many of our politicians seem to work in lockstep against the interests of average people and in favor of big business and the very rich. More and more democracies around the world are sliding into autocracy and oligarchy. Our courts have repealed laws passed in the first decade of the 1900s, both federally and in the states, that made it a crime for contributions to contribute anything of value, quote unquote, to political campaigns, even when voters overwhelmingly support limits on campaign contributions. Because of monopolies, billionaires pay lower tax rates than we do. And the nation's largest companies not only usually pay no taxes at all, but get billions every year in subsidies funded with our tax dollars. So many families have fallen out of the middle class that our country is experiencing epidemics of suicide, opioid addiction, and divorce. Our defense budget is bloated, while our returning soldiers find it harder and harder to get jobs or services. Although it is almost never discussed in our highly monopolized media, monopoly is why right-wing radio and television are found in every nook and cranny, every town, small and large across America, while progressive media are marginalized. It's why our politics are broken and foreign governments have been able to manipulate our elections and seize control of so many of our politicians. The simple fact is that everything, literally everything, exists in some sort of balanced relationship with everything else and does so because everything obeys simple rules to maintain that balance. Break the rules, as both business monopolies and cancer do, and the balance collapses. Most of these rules are the rules of nature. Our bodies, for example, have a complex and delicately balanced immune system that detects when a cell has mutated in a way that it is breaking the rules, and the immune system takes that cell apart, recycling its internal materials. But lacking the proper nutrients to maintain its normal functions, our immune systems, the rule keepers, become less and less able to do their jobs. The result is disease, and in the worst cases, cancer. Similarly, when the rule keepers in political and economic systems are compromised, monopolies emerge just like cancer does in bodies. Those monopolies suck all the resources out of the system and eventually either change it so much that it is no longer functional or push it so far that it collapses. During the first few months of a tumor's growth, if it were self-aware, it would be quite proud of its ability to reroute blood and nutrients away from the other cells and into itself. Similarly, rule breakers are often quite successful, at least for a while. Consider the organized crime mob and its dominance of the construction and real estate industries in New York up until the past few decades. For some time, the mob and oligarch-connected real estate developers like Donald Trump were able to build themselves empires based on unfairly winning against competitors who played by the rules and didn't lie about their properties or hook up with overseas criminal billionaires looking to stash ill-gotten gains or hire illegal undocumented laborers from Poland. In the United States, in large part because of massive changes in the rules of business during the Reagan Revolution, we are now in the cancer stage of capitalism.